Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 40 of the PreparedX Podcast. I can't believe we are now at 40 episodes. In this one, I spoke to Michael Brown, who's the former Undersecretary of Homeland Security. He's also an author. He's also a host of a radio show, iHeartRadio, as well as some other networks on the radio. And again, we'll provide that information in the show notes. But I got speaking to Michael about disaster preparedness on a large scale. So we talked about some significant events. I thought he did a great job in really getting across the first responders' perspective and the amount of time it takes them to get certain things back up and running again after a disaster. So he certainly gave a great perspective and used an example of Puerto Rico, which of course is going through its challenges now after the recent storms that have been through there. So anyway, we got into some more questions and answers around various situations that concern him the most, as well as, of course, touching on exercises as we always do at the end of the interview. Anyway, it was a great interview, and I think you'll enjoy this one. Here's my interview with Michael Brown. Good morning, Michael. How are you today?
I'm great, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Just before we get going here with today's, which is our 40th podcast, which is great. Just before we get going, for our audience, just could you talk for a few minutes about your background and your career to date, please?
Well, I started out as an intern in a municipal government doing police and fire budgets and negotiations and contracts, and went on to become a lawyer. And then in 2000, after the 2000 election, President Bush asked me to become the general counsel of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And then shortly thereafter, the attacks of 9/11 happened. And the president then asked me to become the deputy director of FEMA. And then in the course of everything happening after 9/11, the White House decided to kind of get in front of Congress about creating the Department of Homeland Security. So I was a member of a five-person team that created the structure for the Department of Homeland Security, and I then became the Undersecretary of Homeland Security, one of the four undersecretaries. So I kind of started in the mailroom and worked my way up throughout through emergency management, and it was quite a wild ride, to say the least.
Yeah, for sure. Well, vast amount of experience, and hopefully today you can share some of those experiences with us. So that's great. Again, pleased to have you here. So let's get straight into it, because natural disasters recently, we seem to have I don't know whether it's just the season or what's going on, but a bad season, if you will, certainly on the storm front, and obviously we've seen earthquakes as well, Mexico City more recently. Fairly significant one. But with respect to emergency preparedness, what do you, in your experience, is some of the mistakes that organizations, businesses make in preparing for these types of disasters?
One of the great things, and I have to admit, I get a little bit of pleasure out of doing this, Rob. So some people may criticize me for this, but when I'm speaking to Fortune 100 companies or trade associations or any other number of organizations, I like to ask the audience members a question. And the question is pretty simply phrased one way or another. How many of you think that you are prepared for a natural or man-made disaster, and that your employees, which are obviously critical to the functioning of your organization, that your employees are going to be able to show up for work? And invariably, Rob, 90% of the room puts their hands up. And I chuckle, and I start asking them questions. Well, what if they can't get to work? What if, because of the natural or man-made disaster, they're more concerned about taking care of their own family or their parents or grandparents or someone else, or you can't communicate with them?
Right.
Or they physically cannot get to their work location. And you can see all of a sudden, certainly not the people who are in charge of risk management, they kind of get it. But you can see the people that are in the C-suite, all of a sudden you kind of see their brains start to kind of, it's like the neurons start to fire. They're like,
right,
gee whiz, I never thought about that. And I think it's this idea that if you're a CEO, you know, you've got your CIO and you've got your CFO and you've got your risk management people over here. And so you think everything's humming along great. And you never stop and think about, just as in the military understands that the battle plans go out the window with the first shot. The same is true with any sort of risk management plan, risk assessment thing that you've done, or any sort of emergency plan you have. That goes out the window because we don't know. While we can anticipate risk and mitigate against risk, when that risk actually happens, there are always things that we haven't planned for. And I think that's the one thing that I would try, and I do try every time I speak to these organizations, to get them to think about. Think about the unknowns. Right. Think about the things that you're not thinking about, because that's what's going to cause your company to fail.
Sure. Yeah, the devil is always in those small details. And I think, you know, through planning, through exercises and having those important discussions, which is essentially what you're talking about here, is, you know, challenging yourself around, you know, those discussions and getting down to the nitty gritty, if you will. That's great. So
let me just add one thing. And I think to your point, I think it's incumbent upon whether you're the CEO or whoever is in charge of dealing with your risk manager or whomever, that you really need to have those quarterly or monthly or whatever it is, sit downs where you ask the hard questions and you listen to what the answers are, and then empower those people to put in place the kinds of policies and procedures that you really need.
For sure. For sure. But with regards to some of those specific threats, what concerns you the most? I mean, you've seen probably everything in terms of, you know, threats, be it man-made or natural. But, you know, from your perspective, as we sit here coming into the, you know, the fall of 2017, you know, what are some of the threats that you're really concerned about?
Well, that's, and I'm not trying to be a smart aleck here, but that's kind of like asking me, which is my favorite child. it is, they're all significant, but if I had to prioritize them, I would say first and foremost is cybersecurity. When you think about how absolutely dependent organizations are now on telecommunications, on their databases, on their all of the platforms systems, that they use to provide their products and services, that I don't think we realize how vulnerable those are. So I'd say that's number one. And then the thing I'm most concerned about is, and I think this is true in the most developed countries, whether it's the United States, the United Kingdom, Europe, wherever it might be, we all have infrastructure that is old, it's getting weak. The power grid, I don't think, has been maintained as well as it could, certainly in the United States. And I don't think we all go about our day flipping on the light switch, turning on our computers, using our smartphones,
right,
doing all of this.
Yep.
And we never think about when that gets attacked or that goes down, how are we going to deal with it?
Yeah. And we saw some of the impacts of that certainly right now in Puerto Rico. We certainly saw the Hollywood Hospital in Florida and not having that backup system in place, some basic business continuity challenges. But the impact is just huge if you don't have those plans in place.
Absolutely. And I think one of the responsibilities that I think companies have to recognize, whether you're a privately held company or you're a publicly traded company, is that you ultimately answer to, even if you're a sole proprietor and your livelihood depends upon that business, you need to plan and think about those things. And if you're a publicly traded company, you have a fiduciary obligation not only to your own company, but to the shareholders to say that we have thought through all of those things. And we're doing everything we can to mitigate against those. When you look at when you look at the hacks of different organizations and the stealing of databases and personal information, at some point, shareholders are going to rise up and say, are you really doing everything that you can? And I think that's a legitimate question that shareholders should ask.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And back to your point on cyber as well, you know, we see that in our business as one of the top three scenarios that we've been helping organizations walk through for the last 4 to 5 years, and it seems to be increasing and going beyond the financial services sector, which seemed to focus on cyber as a big part of their risk. And now other organizations throughout other industries are really starting to look at that as being a priority of theirs. And so, yeah, so interesting comments there with regards to those concerns. Michael, talk to me a little bit about, because I want to let the audience see this from, you know, because again, predominantly business people that listen into the podcast, although we do have other folks from, you know, various different public safety entities, as well as other businesses, large and small. But, you know, I want you to talk for a few minutes, if you could, about some of the challenges when there's a large scale, you know, event such as a hurricane, such as, you know, some other natural disaster, or, you know, a significant event that's going to impact a wide, a wide community, if you will, a state in some cases, as we've seen recently with some of the storms. But, you know, what are the first responders faced with? Because we always, you know, we always hear the community saying, well, you know, the first responders weren't there for us. But, you know, we're talking, you know, massive scale here. So some of the big challenges for these first responders?
Well, you have hinted at my answer in that question. And while first responders, I think, would stand up and give me a standing ovation for the answer I'm about to give you, I want to give you that answer, and then I want to take it into some more kind of nitty-gritty responses. I think the first problem that first responders have is public expectations. Mm-hmm. We have developed such an efficient and effective response with firefighters and police and public health that many citizens of Western developed countries think that when something bad happens, that the first responders will be there for them individually within minutes, if not, you know, within hours, if not within minutes. And that simply is not true, particularly in a massive disaster, a catastrophic event, which is why we always tell people, be prepared to rely on yourself for at least 72 hours. So I think the biggest and the foremost problem they have is this level of expectations that first responders will come and save you first before anybody else. And that's just a natural human reaction because, you know, we pay taxes for these efforts and for these men and women. And so when something bad happens, we instinctively as humans think that they're coming to save me and they're going to come and save me first, because we're not thinking about our neighbors or our community or our city or our you know, whatever the political subdivision might be. We're thinking solely about ourselves. So I think they face a problem of too high of expectations. And then the second problem they face, which feeds into the issue of expectations, is the logistical nightmare that first responders have in getting to the area of operations where they need to do their job. Let me use Puerto Rico as an example. So Puerto Rico is all in the news right now, and both the media and the Trump administration are kind of having a battle about what's being done and what's not being done. And I think what both sides are missing, I think the Trump administration is failing to point out what they're doing and the problems they have in getting some stuff done. And the media is being a little disingenuous in not recognizing that all of these other things have to be done before the first responders can actually do their job. So let me give you some specific examples. So Puerto Rico is an island without power, running out of water, running out of food. So there's only two ways to get materials, supply, equipment, and personnel onto that island. You either airlift it or you bring it in by ship. But before you can do either one of those things, before you can land a Chinook helicopter, before you can land a C-130 cargo plane, you have to make sure that the runways, if you're going to use visual flight rules, you have to make sure that the runways are safe for the cargo plane to land. If you're going to use instrument flight rules, you have to set up a temporary air traffic control system so they can land the airplane.
Right.
If you're going to land a Chinook, you have to make certain that the landing zone, that the LZ for that Chinook, who's going to hover and bring down and drop off pallets of supplies, you have to make certain that that area is safe first. So before you can do any of that, you first have to make an assessment. You have to get people into that area to make the assessment. And then once the assessment's made, either start the repairs or give the okay to land or to move the cargo planes or Chinooks in. And with regard to the ships, before you can put a ship into a port, you have to assess the damage to the port.
Right.
And then if it's damaged, you then have to repair the port. And that's not even enough. Let's say you make the damage assessment, you do the repairs, and you get the ship into the port. Nobody ever thinks about the dock. You have to do an assessment of the dock to make sure the dock is safe to offload the cargo. So you may have to do a damage assessment of the port and the dock and do repairs to the dock itself before you can even offload. All of that.
And then it goes further down into the supply chain, right? The infrastructure, the roads, the truck, the rail.
Bingo, Rob. Yeah. You are exactly right. And so I think many people think that because we are these Western societies with all this power and this ability to do these things, yes, we do have all of that power and ability to do those things. But if Mother Nature takes out the infrastructure necessary to do those things, that takes time. And I can tell you from personal experience that if a decision takes 2 minutes, that gets extrapolated to 2 hours in the field, that gets extrapolated maybe into 2 days to something actually being done in the area of operations. And so going back to my point about expectations, I just don't think many people understand all of those logistical nightmares that you have to go through.
Right.
Just for a first responder to be able to do their job.
Oh, that's excellent information. And I think that ties right into kind of my next thought or question, really. And I think it's, you know, for an organization, you know, thinking about, you know, what you've just mentioned there in terms of that timeline, you know, how long can we be without other things that we rely on, such as the grid or other, you know, public-related services. So I think an organization can really start to help themselves for a period of time. And that really, you know, I think you've answered part of my next question, really. Beyond that, what's your advice for organizations that don't consider emergency management planning as being essential to their ability to operate during, and don't forget, after an emergency, as you've just described?
Right. And I think this is the hardest thing to convince organizations to do. It's hard to convince government to do it. It's hard to convince individuals and organizations to do that. And that is to simply mitigate against the potential of every risk that you can identify. For example, where I live personally, I've identified the risks of where I live, not just in my own home, but in my neighborhood and in my city. And organizations have to do the same thing. And it takes money. You actually have to spend money and capital up front to mitigate against those disasters. And too often, CEOs and CFOs look at that money as expenditures that we don't really need to spend. We'd rather buy a new piece of equipment or hire some new people or whatever it might be. And I totally get that, Rob. But think about this. When that crisis hits, that investment that you made prior to that crisis hitting, whether it hits in 1 year, 5 years, or it never hits, that investment that you make up front means that you're going to be up and running before your competitors are, or if you're an individual, you're going to be safe, and you're not going to be dependent upon that first responder that I just described may take several days, several hours, or maybe even a week to get to you. So that investment up front pays in the long run. You just, at least I have found, it's difficult to convince corporations, organizations, and individuals to do that upfront expense.
Yeah. It's certainly our experience as well. And, you know, unfortunately, we learn by events, right? And so when once an event happens, it's, you know, the investment seems to be there.
Right.
Just seems to be the way of the world. You know, as an organization, going back to first responders, really, you know, again, may not be a large scale event, but, you know, could be certainly a localized event or something that happens within your facility. We work with chemical, or, you know, organizations that have chemical plants. We work with organizations, oil and gas, as well as other organizations that have manufacturing sites. And we come up, you know, up against this all the time. And it's about relationships. So can you talk, you know, about the importance of relationships with your first responders as it relates to your business?
I think those relationships are absolutely critical for several reasons. First and foremost, it's just good business to have a relationship with the first responders so they know your business, they know what you do, and you're showing them that you're interested in what they do and how they do their job. Imagine this, a CEO going to first responders in his community, his or her community, and saying, I want to understand how you do your job so that in my business, in doing my continuity planning, my emergency planning, whatever, I can take into account how and what you do in your job so that I can make your job easier. If you say that to a first responder, they're going to bend over backwards to help you in any way because you've just said to them that you want to understand why and how you do what you do so that when a crisis hits, you're going to make their job easier. There's not a person in the world in any sort of business. Let's take this out of the realm of crisis management for a moment. Let's just talk about your vendors. Let's talk about just your customers, anybody else that you have relationships with. When you have those kinds of conversations, that builds a relationship that when an external strain is put on that relationship is strong and less likely to be broken by those external factors.
Great. Yes. Yeah. Great, great points. Look, we as we start to, you know, wrap this thing up here, we as an organization, PreparedX, you know, we conduct a lot of these crisis simulation exercises, and we typically do a lot of tabletops because, you know, financially they're easy for these organizations to commit to.
Right.
Although we do put a fair amount of planning into the ones that we deliver and make them as engaging as possible. We do functional and full-scale exercises as well for certain clients that have, you know, more risk and want to get down into the detail. But, you know, from your perspective, though, and in your experience, what are the three major benefits of conducting simulation exercises?
First and foremost, it is to be as vernacular and crude as I can be. It's usually a slap in the face to the organization that you're doing the exercise with. Because if you have the right kind of injects, if you have the right kind of scenarios established, you're able to show the points of failure that an organization's going to face. And oftentimes that's a wake-up call. So I think that's probably the most important reason to do an exercise, whether it's a simulation, a full field exercise, it's immaterial what kind of exercise. It is that almost shock and awe factor of letting the organization see, either on a simulated basis or in the field, that your planning is good, but there's still a fail point. And we need to recognize that fail point so you can plan and put capital or resources, whatever is needed, against that fail point so you can survive it. So that's the first and I think most important reason. But let's go back to the second. The second reason goes back to your earlier question. It's about developing relationships. When you're doing an exercise and you have first responders and an organization that's involved, or maybe a group of organizations, that in and of itself helps build the relationship between the organizations and the first responders. It allows everybody in a non-pressure situation to understand, oh, you can't do that. Or, oh, yes, we can do that, but it's ineffective because you're not doing this. And that really builds, I think, a strong bond between the people that are involved in the exercise. So that's the second, and I think the second important reason. And then I'd say, here's the third reason. And I always told my people in Homeland Security this. Never be embarrassed by doing an exercise where the exercise fails, because that's the inherent purpose of an exercise. And I think too many times, and I know you guys probably emphasize this when you're doing a simulation. We're not here to have fun. We're not here to pat ourselves on the back. We are here to find out where the points of failure are.
Right.
And we shouldn't be there's no reason to be embarrassed by it. We're not going to set this up so we can all say, oh, look how great we are. We are here to find where the point of failure is. Do not be embarrassed by that. That's why we're doing it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's, you get around the table, and this is the opportunity to have those honest and open conversations and look across the table and, you know, work through, you know, some of those challenges. And again, it's about the continual improvement process. So you're exactly right there. So I appreciate that. Well, you know, Michael, as we wrap up here, this has been an excellent show. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule for us. Do you have any final comments for our listeners? And if they want to get a hold of you or listen to you, how can they do that?
Well, they can listen to me quite easily on iHeartRadio.com or khow.com. My personal website is michaelbrowntoday.com. You can follow me on Twitter at michaelbrownusa. But I would just say this: your listeners have just, and you have just spoke, Rob, you've just spoken to a guy that has seen everything that works, and I have seen things that fail. And I try to explain to people, while failure is never comfortable, while failure is always something that we don't want to kind of deal with, if you look at failure as an opportunity to increase and improve on your own personal resilience,
sure,
on your company's or organization's resilience, failure is a great teaching tool. So I look at my life and my experiences, and I look at the highs, and I think, those were wonderful times. I look at the failures, and I look at the times when the media was bashing me or people were accusing me of not doing everything that needed to be done. And the lessons that I learned from those are probably the more valuable lessons than the lessons I learned when I had great successes. And I think people should apply that to crisis management, and they should apply it to their personal lives too. Resilience is a wonderful thing that God gave us, and we should use that.
Well, that's a great way to wrap that up, and appreciate your honesty and your comments at the end there. Again, I want to thank you for your time today, Michael, and hopefully we'll be in touch with you again soon.
Hope so. It was a great conversation, Rob. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Take care now. Thank you. Well, that's it for episode 40 of the Prepared X podcast. I hope you really enjoyed this one. If you did, please rate us on iTunes and share this podcast. And again, thank you for your time today. Until next time, goodbye.